chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with Nick.
Hi, everyone. Very excited to have you here. Tonight, we have Jason Vojovic. And I practiced that before I said it, so I know it's correct. And Jason and I are going to chat a little bit about his fantastic new book, Marketer in Chief. And we're going to be talking about some interesting presidents, what made them win, what made them lose, what people could have done, and how you can potentially use this in your own personal branding, what Norway can potentially learn in its marketing of presidential candidates. Because as I was saying to Jason, I actually don't know who the current president is, which is bad, especially since I'm going to be going for my permanent residence soon. So yeah, we're going to have hopefully an interesting talk. So Jason, first of all, I'd like to know, where on earth are you?
I am calling right now from Minneapolis, Minnesota in the United States. So right in the center of the country. I'm born and raised a Midwesterner. Yeah, that's what they call it in the United States. This kind of middle, they call it flyover country. So if you've ever been to the United States and you've flown into JFK in New York and then gone on to Los Angeles, you have flown over my house at some point during that time. In the center of the United States, nearest to Chicago, for those of your listeners and viewers who might be familiar with that.
Yeah, I've spoken to quite a few folks from the flyover states. Either they have lots of time to come on to podcasts, or they're just very interesting people. So we'll see by the end of this episode, Jason.
We'll see. No promises.
Cool. So let's talk about your book. Before that, let's start about a bit of your background. To have written a book like this takes obviously research and a bit of understanding of the communications, messaging, branding in the American political system. But let's go into a little bit of your background and how this book came about.
That's a good question. I've been in new product development for the past 25 years. That's marketing, sales, engineering, those, all of the cross disciplines you need in order to launch new products. That's with startups and established organizations, Fortune 500 companies, very broad-based background. And what you learn really quickly in that line of work is that the only people that tend to survive in it for any length of time are just inherently, naturally curious people. You have to just be honestly curious about the world around you, not just I'm going to go and look out for things that are interesting in my field. If I'm working on a medical device, that I'm interested in medical device topics, I'm interested in everything. And it's one of those things I can't turn off. And sometimes that's great at cocktail parties, and it can irritate those who love and care for you sometimes. So I try to keep that to myself. And I've always been interested in history. I consider it my unfair competitive advantage, because studying history not only satisfies a lot of curiosity, but it helps me understand why things are the way they are. What happened? What were the real stories? So that when I'm thinking about creating the future, what is that next new thing that I'm going to help somebody create? It really pays to know what has happened before, what things have been tried before, how did things go before, what was successful, what wasn't. That doesn't mean that it will be successful or unsuccessful in the future, but it's such a richer and broader kind of tapestry that I can bring forward. Because when you think about launching a new product, much of the time, it's connections between unrelated things that get brought together, create something new. If you're not curious and you don't see a lot of different things and you're not looking at different things, it's hard to know, oh, hey, this over here connects to this over here. And if we put those two things together, we could launch something new that people would really appreciate, would really solve some vexing problem. It was natural that I would be looking at that. I've always been interested in history generally, presidential history specifically. And in 2020, when the world shut down, I worked on, it's one of those, we all had pandemic projects, right?
Yeah.
Many of us did. I did. Mine was each week I would research and write about probably 3,000 to 5,000 words on each US president. Not just the cool ones, not just the ones people have heard of, but all of the US presidents. And I would publish those to my blog. And the blog got super popular. And enough people said you should put those into a book. And foolishly, I agreed and thought that I'd put them all together, edited them, and published them in 2021. Very exciting. A long, strange trip it was to get from there to here. But that's kind of who I am and why I did it.
So I love the title Marketer in Chief, because if we think about modern politics, we think there's a lot of marketing, a lot of branding, a lot of money going into campaign ads, super PACs and things like that. But I guess we forget that there have been 46 presidents now? And each of them has had to sell their particular vision to the country. And that is a lot of horse trading. That's getting your message right. That's a lot of personality branding. And so I'm sure all 45, especially 46 now, is going to have a lot of rich content for the next generation of writers as well. The last two have been doozies. But let's talk about maybe a little bit about your writing process. So you said you were writing it initially for a blog, because I haven't heard millions of product development folks and product managers coming up with best-selling books, which I'm hoping this becomes really soon, if it isn't already. But I think the title alone is fantastic, which is why I reached out to you. Let's start with maybe some of the key learnings that you got out of this book, and perhaps who are some of your lesser known but most interesting presidents that you've discovered as you've written this book?
I think the thing I want people to take away from the book, and not just Americans, but I think there's that anyone trying to, in any sort of representative democracy, direct democracy, any sort of parliamentary system, you've got a scenario where 95% of the people, 95% of the time, really aren't paying attention to politics. For those people who are into politics, it's almost like a sport for them. They're into it all the time, but most people aren't. So when you think about the leadership, especially the prime minister, a president, or someone in that leadership position, what they're really trying to do is they are selling a brand. They're selling an idea. They're selling people getting excited about it and wanting to be a part of it and wanting to move things forward. And each leader really has that responsibility to do that. And the whole idea behind Marketer in Chief, and the subtitle is how each president sold the American idea. And what was interesting is that most people think about the executive branch in any government as more of an administrator, someone who's just trying to make sure that things happen. When you take a look at kind of the business side of it, and just from my perspective, just making sure that you've got the right mousetrap doesn't mean that people buy the mousetrap. You need to make sure that people not only know about it, they're excited about it. Thinking about Sun Tzu said the art of war, that war under no circumstances could be ignored. It's of vital importance to the state. I would paraphrase that to say marketing is of vital importance to any leader. You're that brand, that idea. Under no circumstances can it be avoided, whether you like it or not. And certain presidents in the American system did better than others. I think when we get up to the more recent presidents, Biden, Trump, Obama, Bush, those sort of folks, much of what we learn can be clouded by recent politics and by really emotional issues for a lot of people. Although there are things to learn from them, we really need to take a step back and leave living memory for some of the presidents that really made an amazing impact. And there are a couple of presidents that most people wouldn't maybe even be familiar with outside of the United States, and frankly, many not in the United States. But your listeners in Belgium might recall Herbert Hoover. During World War I, Hoover led the relief effort to help make sure that Belgium didn't starve during that time. They still have statues to him all over the place. They still have plaques for him in the embassy in Washington, D.C. Hugely popular there, and frankly, hugely popular in the United States during the 1920s. If you remember, during the 1920s was a huge era for new innovation, new products, the roaring 20s in the United States. Herbert Hoover was an engineer by training, a mining engineer. And what he did was he would bring, there were automobiles were just going onto the American roads at that time. But imagine this, no traffic laws, no standardization for roads, no standardization for safety features, nothing. Herbert Hoover didn't write the legislation as the Secretary of Commerce. He brought together drivers groups, he brought together insurance, he brought together car manufacturers, put them in a room and said, we're going to figure this out. We're going to set some rules. He did the same thing with aviation, the same thing with Hollywood, the same thing with housing and the mortgage industry. So when you think about a president like that, not the person who's out there and creating this brand for himself, no snappy slogans. He was just the kind of person who did the nuts and bolts work of marketing. Things where you had to bring people together, make things happen. Now, mostly we in the United States, we remember Herbert Hoover for presiding over the 1929 stock market crash.
Yeah.
When you think about Herbert Hoover's legacy before 1929 and after 1929, it's night and day. He was a shoe-in for the president of the United States. Absolutely. People loved him. And after 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt beat him, he became really a pariah and has been a butt of a joke ever since. But really, a little bit unfair to criticize him completely for a complete collapse of the financial system.
And that's where it comes into timing. I'm actually a big fan
timing
of
matters.
Herbert. Yeah, I'm quite a fan of Herbert Hoover. I read quite a lot about that, the palaver over the financial crash and how he did his level best to try and fix it and probably helped America weather quite a lot of that storm. But it was beyond his control. And I think, as you said, he's become a pariah in a laughing stock in terms of American presidents, or his legacy has
been tarnished
and degraded. And I think we can see a parallel perhaps during COVID with Donald J. Trump in terms of the same thing. On a high, something uncontrollable comes in, good things are happening and reputation down the drain. So this is where history is important in seeing in terms of there are parallels in other presidents, in other presidencies. Are there any other such interesting parallels like that? There are these, we can talk about FDR in terms of being a dictator, basically, during the, or not being elected, I think, during the World War. So being taking a couple of extra years versus other presidents and his legacy and the amazing things that he did until Truman took over.
FDR was interesting that he won 4 elections. No U.S. president has been in office more than 2 terms. FDR was a 4-term president. Part of that, of course, was the Great Depression. But once World War II started, there was no, George Washington set the precedent of 2 terms. But there was no law in the United States for that until FDR, until the Truman administration. So you could run a 3rd and a 4th time, and he did. The 4th time, it was pretty clear that he was not going to survive a full 4-year term. And that's why he was so careful to pick a successor who would be up to the job, which is an interesting story about Truman, how that all happened.
That's the thing. Truman was not really seen as how do you go from FDR to Truman? But he really filled some big shoes and did a tremendous job afterwards, which wasn't expected. I think he was a bit like Pence, sort of left in the background. Nobody really took him seriously. But then he took over the war effort and bombed Japan, etc., did these tremendous things, which people weren't necessarily anticipating from him. And if I believe he did get reelected after that.
He did. Yeah, that was the 1948 election is one of the most famous in U.S. history. I talk about it in the book, where he was running against Thomas Dewey from New York, there's a famous newspaper that says Dewey defeats Truman and he's holding it up smiling. Yeah. Most people remember that. What people don't know is that Truman was not just running against Dewey. He was running against 2 other Democrats, one on the progressive side and one on the old Southern Democrat side, and beat both of them and Dewey for the presidency in 1948. What's interesting, I think, Truman is one of my favorite case studies for presidents generally. And you're absolutely correct, Nicholas, in that he wasn't expected to perform as well as he did. And that's because people didn't know him. Mm-hmm. And people didn't really understand the kind of person he was. David McCullough's biography, Truman, is one of the best, and I would unconditionally recommend that one to any of your listeners. Basically, what Truman was the type of person, and one of these stories is instructive. He was put in charge of the Truman Committee, what became known as the Truman Committee as a senator. His job was to root out corruption and double dealing in war profiteering by government contractors, big business in the United States. And most committees like this, you've got a senator who's a figurehead who just sits there and has hearings, and it's just all for show. Harry Truman was the kind of guy who got in his car, drove across the country to wherever the contractor was, and showed up at their door and said, "Hi, I'm Senator Truman. You're going to let me in, and I'm going to look at your books. I'm going to look at your operation. And if I don't like what I see, I'm going to shut you down." And he is credited with saving the country billions and billions of dollars in contracts during the war years, and making sure that this big story that came out later of all the big businesses, you know, did their all for the war effort. Trust but verify. Truman was the guy who made sure that they were doing their patriotic duty.
Yeah.
So just an amazing person. But you made a comment about what other presidents have had that kind of the hit of bad luck. And it's funny that you mentioned the peanut farmer president, Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
Another engineer, by the way. So engineers have had bad luck in the American political system. But Jimmy Carter ran into the same sort of problem, where he was dealing with the oil embargo, economic collapse, really struggled in the late 1970s, and very much had the same sort of, did a lot of things, tried really hard, but in the end, just didn't have the, missed a little bit of the branding side, kind of the personal charisma that both FDR had and Ronald Reagan had, both successors. Generally much more well-regarded than either of them, really because they understood what Hoover and Carter did, which is you could do all of the stuff, you could have all the steak, but if there is no sizzle, it's like they served a $100 steak on a $5 paper plate.
Yeah, and I think your point in terms of how you've got to show what you've delivered and you've got to make a bit of razzmatazz around it. And I think a good example of that and how Reagan played Carter like a banjo is with the Iran-Contra issue, where he got the Iranians to release all of those folks after the inauguration. I think that was Reagan. And whereas Carter had done all the heavy lifting, they knew how to play the press, play the media, and play public sentiment. And I think people underestimate public sentiment and how important that is in timing of elections, timing of when you should launch new products or how you should promote right. yourself.
I think most politicians who don't succeed very well, frankly, there's kind of two types of politicians, right? You've got the types like the Carter and Hoover, and you've got politicians like that in the United States. You have them all over the EU as well. The politicians who are more technocrats.
Yeah.
They're very good at getting things done, but they're not exciting. We have those. You mentioned Mike Pence in the United States. Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota, fits that sort of mold as well. Very good at getting things done. But when she ran for the Democratic nomination in last cycle, bowed out very quickly. There just wasn't that kind of excitement around that was needed. But on the other hand, you have politicians who are essentially all style and no substance. And we have those politicians in the United States on both sides of the aisle. You have them in the EU as well. All they're good at is just getting out there and giving some speeches and getting people fired up, but there's nothing behind them. It's all having a candy bar, no meal.
Yeah.
And what you find is that the successful politicians understand that they need to do both things. And they are very rare, by the way, those who can do both things well. FDR was great at it. Going back further, in the United States, Thomas Jefferson was very good at it. He understood it. People like Ronald Reagan understood it. Very few politicians get that, though, and are good at something like that. Teddy Roosevelt was very good at that in the early part of the 1900s. In the EU, you have preciously few politicians like that as well. But again, we remember them because it is very rare to have someone who can get things done and make you excited about the things they got done. That is not easy to do.
And I think the contrast between the States and Europe is that Europe has had dictators and despots. So they absolutely avoid personalities, which is why nobody can mention who is the president of what country, except perhaps Orban from Hungary. Nobody knows who the German chancellor is now. France, maybe some people will recognize. But there are no personalities because they are terrified of personalities. America hasn't had a despot, which means that they are still running and if I can make a parallel with America taking over the mantle of Rome in terms of being a republic, it's actually the republic of, it should be the Republic of America in a sense, because you've got your Senate and you've got your Caesar or your elected president. And you luckily haven't had a despot. The closest to a despot was potentially FD in terms of that he would have just been continuing.
He actually got the closest. People think that it is like a Donald Trump, that Donald Trump was the closest thing we had to a dictator.
Yeah.
Not true at all. FDR was the closest. And it's interesting that during the 1930s, it was not a sure thing. That was the age of dictators, especially in Europe, the rise of fascism and communism in Europe, the rise of dictatorships. It was not at all obvious in the United States that the United States would not go in that direction as well. And FDR was very good. What I think the best thing FDR did from a marketing perspective is he did just enough dictatorial stuff to make things happen, but pulled back enough. FDR was probably the best balancer we have had in the United States system. He was very good at blunting his critics by doing just a little bit. So if business got really mad at him because the government was restricting wages, he would back off just a little bit. He'd push far and then he'd back off. Or if someone was attacking him from the progressive left, they wanted to go completely socialist, completely communal ownership of everything. He'd go just a little bit in that direction. And what that would do is it would peel off lots of the support, people who thought a little bit of that's a good thing, but I don't want to go that far.
Yeah.
So instead of them being able to peel off votes, he basically was able to make everybody else marginal. So he wasn't really as much a dictator as he was very good at marginalizing every other voice in the political system. He was a master at it, and no one has gotten even close to as good as he was.
Yeah, I think he really was a standout in terms of a global politician. But it's quite astounding if one thinks about World War II at the quality of leadership. No matter what you think about Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and these folks, they were phenomenal politicians. And you had Churchill, you had FDR, you had Stalin, you had Hitler, a collection of the biggest names. Maybe it's because it's recent history, but in that era, to have that level of world-changing politicians at the same period is quite staggering if one thinks about it.
We don't really see anything like that until the kind of revolutionary era in Europe. There's that kind of 1840 to 1870 kind of period where you had a number of different revolutions of varying types around there, kicking off with the post-Napoleonic, a European era. You get a lot of really interesting European politicians during that time. You had the American Civil War during that time. They don't call it the Age of Revolutions for nothing. That was probably the last time you saw a lot of those really interesting people at that time. But I would agree with you, the middle of the 20th century, seeing the number and the types and the strength of personalities that we really had during that time is what makes it such a fascinating period that even 80 years later, it's still, when you take a look at how many books get sold on Amazon at different historical periods, World War II still remains the biggest section in U.S. history today. I don't know about globally, but it outsells pretty much every other type of history in the United States.
I think it's sharks, Hitler, World War II, how the ratings work. But we haven't even discussed the likes of Patton, Montgomery, Marshall.
And
Rommel, and who's that wonderful American with the corn cob pipe? I don't know why his name is vanished now. I'm going to went back to the Philippines, Luzon, all of that.
MacArthur.
Come on, MacArthur. Just wonderful stories. And they were all personalities and had brands behind them. Look at Patton's brand. Look at Rommel's brand. Look at Montgomery's brand with the two badges. They all embodied something that got people behind them. And the stories behind these folks are just marvelous.
I actually find those are the more interesting ones of that era than I find Truman and FDR. Interesting. Eisenhower, interesting for sure.
Yeah.
But there is so much talent there on the Japanese side, the Chinese side. The Indian leadership during that time is just fascinating.
Yeah.
It's such a rich era. And I sometimes feel like the politicians and the leaders that we have today, the talent bench, we could use if we could pinch hit and we could go back and grab five people from that era to bring them here, those would be the ringers. That's really who we need. We don't quite have that talent pool right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, but that's what hard times create, is these folks get popped out of nowhere almost. And a lot of them languished for many years doing nothing. If you look at Marshall and you look at a whole bunch of these other folks, they were doing middle of the road jobs. They were very good administrators and so on. And then were just at the right place at the right time, and made an enormous
impact. Created great people. It created great people all the way. That crucible, and that's usually what they talk about, the crucible of that era created great people, great men and women all over the world.
This is where we could go and have a discussion about leadership and how leaders are only great because of the people that they build around them and surround themselves with. But that's going to be another discussion. I'm sure we can chat about that. What I want to talk about is slightly more recent history. And
sure.
I want to know your thoughts on how on earth did Hillary Clinton lose to Donald J. Trump? And I must just put a caveat. I'm a huge fan of Donald Trump. I think he is the most entertaining figure in modern history. Might not like all of his aspects, but he is just... he knocks the socks off all of the other contenders. And I'm just wondering and I've got some thoughts on Hillary Clinton, on why she lost, but I'd love to get your point on how did she mess this up?
There's a few things. One is, love him or hate him, Donald J. Trump is entertaining. He's just entertaining. There's no question about that. He does understand that at an intuitive level. And even those who dislike him, if you deny that, you'll keep losing to him.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I
think there are a couple of key reasons that Hillary Clinton struggled with this. And it comes back to things we've already talked about. That kind of Hillary Clinton was not an engineer, but she had an engineering, technocratic way of running things. She is a technocrat. She is someone who is very good at kind of the mechanics and the levers of things, of getting things done, understands how government works and believes in how government works at a fundamental level, very much the stake side, but didn't concentrate enough, like a Hoover and a Carter and other presidents we've had, frankly, did not focus enough on the sizzle, didn't get people excited about it. She was just very good at kind of the mechanics of it. And I think she believed that, and many people believe, not just her, but many people in the Democratic, the left-wing party in the United States, really felt like kind of the idea of the first female president of the United States was enough. That was enough of an excitement. What they realized is what any marketing and product development person knows, is that what people tell you they will do and what they're excited about and what they will actually buy or vote for are two very different things. So I think that's the number one reason, is too much steak, not enough sizzle, not enough of a balance. I think the second thing, though, is that Donald J. Trump's team understood something about a unique factor of the American electoral map that is a little foreign to the folks in Europe. They don't quite do it the same way. We have a thing called the Electoral College. And what the Electoral College says is that if you win a state by one vote, and there are a couple of exceptions to this, but for all the states that matter, if you won New York by one vote, you get all of New York's electoral votes go to you. If you lose California by one vote, all of the Californias go to the other person. In the United States, it's very state by state at the presidential level. You think about winning states. Now, what Trump's team understood is something that Calvin Coolidge understood and first figured out. He was the first one, along with Bruce Barton, who I talk about mostly in the book during his chapter, figured out that, hey, listen, the Electoral College means that if we're not really going to be close in Georgia, for instance, you know what? There's just no way we're going to get to 50.00001% in Georgia. Don't try.
Yeah.
You can have a nominal effort there, but concentrate on those states where you know you can win and don't worry about the ones where you can't. And Coolidge was successful, super, super successful, and really understood how to make that work. He was the first one to really understand and take advantage of the electoral system in that way. And Trump's team understood that, hey, we're not going to New York, California, not going to worry about Texas. We don't have to worry about it. It's going for us anyway. They concentrated on about a half a dozen places where they knew that all they needed to do was get 5, 10, 15,000 votes would do it. And it's interesting that now in the United States, you get a lot of people who really claim that the 2020 election was stolen by Joe Biden because of those few states and how few votes really got the difference. Trump did the same thing to Hillary in 2016.
Yeah.
And it was the Democrats team in 2016, 2017, 2018 who said the election was stolen from them for exactly the same reason. By the way, the exact same reason, which was very few votes in those states can flip the whole thing. And if you flip Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that's really it. Now, Trump overperformed in a few states. I think there were a lot of people who didn't really like Hillary Clinton, and just for whatever reason, didn't really like her. So he overperformed a bit and was able to take that election. And you saw that he was not able to overperform again in 2020. And Joe Biden was able to beat him pretty easily, no matter what the, you know, what the conspiracy theorists might say, really wasn't that close. Joe Biden was able to beat him pretty convincingly. Would he be able to do it again? That's tough to say.
Yeah. So some really interesting points then, especially about how to play the game. And I think that's what Trump mentioned, is that he just played, he knew the rules and he played by the rules. And that Hillary Clinton didn't, she'd been in the industry for years and didn't know the basics of the game, meant that she lost. They took things for granted. And for me, the interesting thing that came out of this is that it's not about getting 90% of the vote, as you said. It's getting 50 plus one. And that's all you need. And I think, and in statistics, again, you only need 51% to have a positive correlation on something. You don't need 77. You can make a decision on, it's not great, but you can make a decision on that. And I feel that Hillary tried to be the everyman. She wanted to make every single demographic love her. And everybody must feel the Clinton wave and the love of Hillary Clinton. And she forgot about basic politics, which is that half the people are going to love you, half the people are going to hate you, and the other half, you've got to sway over to your side. And I think Trump got that. And this is why I wanted to go back to marketing and messaging. His messaging was super clear. There were three things. And no matter what the conversation was, what the discussion was, he made sure you understood what his three points were. Even now, you could probably recite what his three selling points were. What were Hillary Clinton's selling points? You can remember Hope Hopey Changey from Barack Obama, but who knows what Hillary was about? She expected to win and didn't put up a compelling message. And that was fatal for her.
That in product development all the time. For someone like me, it wasn't surprising at all. But you saw the type of messaging, and I could, there's an old saying, and it's in the chapter on Jimmy Carter, which is great. And he had an advisor who said that people don't listen to the specifics of political messages. They listen to the beat and the rhythm. And he equated it to, they watch politicians like they listen to rock and roll music, because rock and roll music was big at the time.
Yeah.
He'd say hip hop today. He said, people feel the beat and the rhythm. They feel the emotion, but they don't listen to the words. Like, if you had a favorite rock and roll song or a favorite hip hop song, do you know the words?
Nope.
Most people don't, but you get the beat, right? He understood that what people are really, like most people who aren't into politics, are feeling the energy that's coming off that person. And again, like Donald Trump or don't like Donald Trump isn't really material. He was clear. As you said, he was very clear. He had a personality that even if he didn't like what he was saying, he was confident. You didn't have to get the specifics. You felt that he was confident. You felt that he was on top of things. You felt that he had energy. And even if you didn't listen to any of the specifics, when he was up there, you just had that kind of emotional feeling. Now, I'm not talking about the people who love him or the people who hate him. Take those two groups aside, because he understood it. I agree with you. He understood kind of what Hillary Clinton didn't quite get is that you'll never win over the folks on the other side who are in that tribe. It's the people in the middle who aren't paying much attention, but I have a better feeling about that person than I do about that one. And that's the biggest predictor of what they're going to do when they're in the voting.
Yeah.
It is actually not a good predictor to look at policies and kind of rational arguments. The best predictors are emotional. And we saw the same thing with, there's a video, the famous video of Ballmer from Microsoft, Steve Ballmer, laughing at Steve Jobs in the iPhone, making fun of it and laughing at it. And I got it. The folks at Nokia were doing the same thing. The folks at BlackBerry were doing the same thing. They did not take it seriously. They didn't understand it. And looking at it then, I said, this guy's going to take over the world with this thing. Whenever you see establishment folks laughing at a newcomer, that's the kiss of death.
Yeah.
It's almost the best thing you can do to predict that person's going to lose hard. When they get laughed at, when they're not taking it seriously. And I don't think the Clinton campaign took Trump seriously until way too late in the game. And they paid for it.
Yeah. You talk about that 1% or that middle belt.
It's about a third. It's about a third
swing the elections. And it's very interesting. If you go to fairgrounds, and I'm sure you might have done this, you've got to guess the weight of the pig. Or how many beans are in a jar. And it's amazing how the average generally is correct. There is a knowledge in averages. And I saw this wonderful program on just how the knowledge of crowds in terms of creating averages. Somebody might go totally one side and the other side. But generally, people have a pretty good understanding of what reality really is. And it's those folks, like you say, who are going to swap things around. Now, there's a new election. It's my most exciting season. I'm going to cancel Disney. I'm going to cancel Netflix. I'm going to cancel all of my, because this is the World Series of entertainment coming up. And I'm super excited because there are a couple of really interesting characters. There's Vivek Ranswamy, who I think knows he's not going to win the Republican nomination, but he is playing up to being vice president. Because he's taken over, I think, from poor old Florida
DeSantis,
who I thought had great potential, but he peaked too soon. Trump obviously will get the Republican nomination, but what is going on with the Democrats? There's no ways that a 70 or nearly 80-year-old Joe Biden is going to get the left-wing Democratic nomination, unless they know they're just going to give up this election and put their attention on another contender in the next election, which possibly looks like what they're doing.
It does seem to me that I think both parties are planning for the inevitability that Trump and Biden may be at the top of each respective ticket, and that either one of them, if they were elected, the presidency is very hard on people. And even though both of them, Joe Biden is a healthier person overall than Donald Trump from a health perspective, but both of them will be approaching 80,
yeah,
passing 80 at that time. The chances that they would be the oldest presidents, and the chances that there's a very real possibility that one or both of them would not survive over the next 5 years. So both of them need to take a very morbid calculation that whoever is elected, we are in the United States electing a vice president this,
yeah,
time around. That's what I don't think people have quite understood yet, that it's not really Trump or Biden.
Yeah.
It's going to be between Vivek, who I know people who know, he's in the entrepreneur business community here, or someone on the Democratic side that would be the nominee. And I think
won't be Kamala, will it?
That's unlikely. I think the money, the betting people are looking at Newsom from California.
Yeah.
They're looking at other folks, maybe Pete Buttigieg. That's a bit of a long shot. I think,
yeah,
the Gavin Newsom is the would-be people's...
It'd be the easiest sell.
Probably the easiest sell right now. You're never going to have people who, you know, say it's California and liberal California. You know what? You're never going to convince, you know, the hard right folks to like him. And he knows that. He gets that. It would be better if he were from a swing state like Florida, frankly. But Ron DeSantis, I tend to agree with you. I think he peaked a little bit too early. And I think he is struggling. He does understand what we've been talking about. He understands that you need steak and sizzle. But he's a state guy. Ron,
yeah,
DeSantis is a state guy trying to add a little sizzle. And it's hard when steak people add a little sizzle. It can really come off as awkward,
yeah,
and difficult. It's actually easier for sizzle people to surround themselves with steak people, which is what Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan is, not to say he was a dumb person, he wasn't very smart, but much more of a performer. He got his start in the 1930s in radio broadcasting. He was a performer. He understood,
yeah,
that and surrounded himself with people who would take care of the policy details. Very easy to go in that direction, hard to go the other way. So I think about someone like a DeSantis. I always knew he was going to have trouble doing that. I think Vivek Ramaswamy is much, much better at that. And I think he is a tremendous competitor. I think he is very underestimated by both the right and the left right now, as far as just the ability to put on a show and back it up with a very high IQ. He is a very smart person. I think Donald Trump would do very well to run with him on that side. I don't know if Joe Biden were to run with Newsom from California. That would be an entertaining race to watch.
Yeah, I think those two. Newsom hasn't had necessarily the best track record in California. People
but
have
that doesn't
bounced,
matter.
Yeah,
yeah, it doesn't
bounced,
really matter.
Have bounced back from that. But I did Klobuchar, like you mentioned, so she was quite lovely. But again, you couldn't take her seriously as a presidential candidate. She just didn't have that sizzle, like you mentioned. I just want to talk about one last president, and then,
yeah,
we're going to talk about some final points about your book. Sorry, that was my very poor Ronald Reagan.
That's pretty good. That's not bad. I like that. That's a good one.
And it's about the rehabilitation of Nixon. And of his message, because he was quite an unlikable character, even when he was president. I don't think he really got people. But he still was a very effective president. He opened up China. He was, and obviously with Kissinger as his roving number two, did quite a phenomenal job. And I think as a president, did a good job. But he got caught out doing some really Boy Scout nonsense.
Which he did not need to do.
Exactly.
the tragedy of Richard Nixon, and he was not a likable guy. You read about him. He's just not someone you'd want to go have a beer with. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Tended to be very effective, really understood the mechanics of government, understood geopolitical mechanics, understood electoral politics at pretty grassroots level, definitely understood the mood of the country in the 1960s, that it had gone a little too far and that people were a little frustrated with that. He understood it. You can call that lots of bad things if you want, and those are fair things to call it, but he definitely understood it. You can't say he wasn't a good politician. He was a very good politician.
Yeah.
The point was, in his reelection, he had it in the bag. There's just no way. The Democratic Party of the time was in complete disarray. It was a complete mess. There was no chance that Humphrey was going to win. There's no chance. No one was there that was going to beat him. And he just had personality defects that made him so paranoid that he couldn't handle winning 80%. He had to win 100%. And that's that fatal flaw, that tragedy, is he just couldn't do that. But in my book, I talk about, I sidestep all of that and just say, listen, what you need to look at, a different way to look at it, is just look at the objective data during that time. Let's look at quality of life. Let's look at housing prices. Let's look at inflation. Let's look at all of the things that day-to-day people are going to care about. How did they do during Nixon's presidency? And on the whole, very well.
Yeah.
Things did run, on the whole, very well. That doesn't mean that there weren't issues. It doesn't mean that there weren't problems. But on the whole, things went pretty well. That's the type of politician that wins an electoral college landslide, who will get 80% of the electoral college votes, which in the United States is all that matters.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, which people do know now, that's only happened a few times. It doesn't matter if you win the popular vote. That's not how the system works.
Yeah.
So yeah, from a rehabilitation perspective, I still do think we need about another 30 to 50 years for people to look back at Richard Nixon's time a little bit more objectively than they can now. Richard Nixon is still in living memory for many, many people, and people have still pretty strong feelings about him, where if I were to have a conversation with you about William McKinley, you know what? No one's going to, you know, people at the time had very strong feelings about McKinley that they don't now.
Yeah.
We need more time. I think we're a little early on the rehabilitation for Nixon, but I think it will come.
Yeah.
This isn't going to come in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. It's interesting seeing the parallels between Roman and Egyptian politics. So where they had, I can't remember what the exact term is, but where they absolutely destroy every reference and mention of that particular king, his activities, and put on, there's a wonderful word for it. I'll have to put it as a little title here. But, you know, that's happened to a couple of American presidents who've just disappeared from view. And again, it's all living memory things. The closer to we are to history, the more real it is to us. In terms of your book, some of the main messages that come out of that you think people should read it, that they should read it for, is it the history? Is it the content? Is it specific messaging? How can I get folks to buy your book after we've gone through only 5 presidents?
I think that the biggest thing that will be interesting to people is that I write about 3,000 to 5,000 words on every president. So there are going to be a lot of presidents you had no idea even existed, but why they were important and why they were important in their time and the kind of lessons that they can provide. For example, most people don't know who William Henry Harrison is, the 9th president. He was the 9th president for 31 days. This guy caught pneumonia during Inauguration Day and died about a month later. Sad story. What's special about William Henry Harrison? Harrison was the first person whose political opponents tried to use an argument against him that he turned on their heads. Basically, they said, hey, he was just like an old granny who wanted to sit in his log cabin and just drink hard cider. Like, he's not really up to the task here. What Harrison did is during his campaign events, and you already know where this is going, he had them at log cabins, and he gave everyone hard cider. And he just made it into it. He had buttons with hard cider and log cabins on them. And he went out and he just owned it. And what was special about that is he was the very first person who took that insult. And instead of trying to combat the insult, he said, no, I'm going to own it. This is going to be me. And I'm going to use that and I'm going to turn it into an advantage. It's stories like that throughout the history that are so much more interesting. Yes, FDR is interesting and Reagan is interesting. But I will tell you, I promise you that all 45, it's 45 people because Grover Cleveland was president twice, non-consecutively. Okay. 45 people are tremendously interesting. There's so much you can learn. And I'm a product development and marketing person. So if you're in business and you're thinking about how do I use these kind of lessons, how can I apply this to my business? I promise you, in each one, that's my perspective. I can help you do that. And you'll read history. You will not read another history book like this. I promise. You'll really like it.
I'm super excited to read it. So I'm going to put a link in the description of the podcast so people can go and get it. But how can people get in touch with you, or what's the easiest? Where can I send folks to reach out to you, Jason?
The good news and the bad news about having a unique name like Jason Voyovich is that I am very easy to find online.
Okay.
So people can go and search for me on Amazon. They can search for me on LinkedIn. I am the only one. I'm like Tigger. I'm like Tigger.
The
most wonderful thing about Tiggers is he's the only one. I am the only one of my kind. You can find me there. My personal website, jasontvoyovich.com, has links to the book, paperback, the audio book, available on Amazon in every country. It's not translated.
Yeah,
but you can buy it in the EU, and lots of people do. Which surprises me to no end. By the way, I did not expect that. My second biggest market is the UK, then Australia, then Germany. It totally surprises me. But they can buy it there. They can buy. I have another book there called "Booze, Babe, and the Little Black Dress." It's about the 1920s specifically. So that book is there. You can read other things and connect with me there. So if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, you know how to find me. Just say that you're on Nicholas's podcast and you'd like to connect with me. No problem.
I'll do that. And then I think our next chat will be about your other book, because that also looked fascinating. I must just joke about you being the only Jason Voyovich on LinkedIn. Somebody called Nick Kuna on LinkedIn came up into my feed. So I said, hey, let's have a chat on a podcast. And he's a product development specialist as well. So we had a good hoot about that. Jason, this has been fascinating. This is, as you can tell, a topic I really love, and I could talk to you all night. And I'm sure there are more stories like that, a hard side of which I love already. So I'm going to make sure I read that. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to having you on really soon.
Thank you again for having me. I loved it.
Chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth.